When Craig awoke, the first morning light was diffusing through the hole in the roof of the cavern, milky and blued by the smoke from the cooking fire where the girls were busy preparing the morning meal. While they breakfasted, and with Wuzamanzi's reluctant permission, Craig related in English the outlines of the tale of Lobengula's reburial to Sarah and Sally Ann. They were both enthralled, and immediately on fire to join the expedition. "It is a difficult place to reach," the old man huffed, "and it is not for the eyes of mere woman folk." But Sarah smiled her sweetest, stroked the old man's head and whispered in his ear, and finally, after a further show of gruff severity, he relented. Under Wuzamanzi's direction, the men made a few simple preparations for the expedition. In one of the ancillary branches of the cavern beneath a flat stone was a hidey-hole containing another kerosene lantern, two native axes and three large coils of good-quality nylon rope, which the old man clearly prized highly. "We liberated this fine rope from the army of Smithy during the Bush War," he boasted. "One great blow for freedom," Craig murmured, and Sally Ann frowned him to silence. They set off down one of the branches of the cavern, Wuzamanzi leading and carrying one of the lanterns, followed by Tungata with one of the rope coils, the girls in the centre, and Craig with the second coil of rope and the other lantern in the rear. Wuzamanzi strode along the passage as it narrowed and twisted. When the passage forked, he did not hesitate. Craig opened his clasp knife and marked the wall of the right-hand fork, and then hurried to catch up with the rest of the party. The system of tunnels and caves was a three-dimensional maze. Water and seepage had mined the limestones of the hills until it was as perforated as a Gruyere cheese. In some places they scrambled down rock scree, and at one point they climbed a rough natural staircase of limestone. Craig blazed every twist and turn of the way. The air was cold and dank and musky with the smell of guano. Occasionally there was a flurry of shadowy wings around their heads, and the shrill squeal of disturbed bats echoed down the passageways. After 20 minutes, they came to an almost vertical drop of glossy, smooth limestone, so deep that the lantern glow did not reach the depths. Under Wuzamanzi's direction, they secured the end of one coil of nylon rope to a pillar of limestone, and one at a time slid down 50 feet to the next stage. This was a vertical fault in the rock formation, where two geological bodies had shifted slightly and formed an open crack in the depths of the earth. It was so narrow that he could touch either wall, and in the lantern light Craig could just make out the bright eyes of the bats hanging inverted from the rocky roof above them. Uncoiling the second rope behind him as he went, Wuzamanzi cautiously climbed down the treacherous floor of the crack. The crack widened as it descended, and the roof receded into the gloom above their heads. It reminded Craig of the great gallery in the heart of Cheops' pyramid, a fearsome cleft through living rock, dangerously steep, so they had to steady themselves with the rope at every pace. They had almost reached the limit of the rope when Wuzamanzi halted and stood tall on a tilted slab, lit by his own lantern, looking like a black Moses descended from the mountain. "What is it?" Craig called. "Come on down," Tungata ordered, and Craig scrambled down the last slope and found Wuzamanzi and the others perched on the rock slab, peering over the edge into the still surface of a subterranean lake. "Now what?" Sally Ann asked, her voice muted with awe of this deep and secret place. The lake had filled the limestone shaft. Across the surface, 150 feet away, the roof of the shaft dipped into it at the same angle as the floor on which they stood. Craig used the flashlight that they had salvaged from the wrecked Cessna for the first time. He shone it into the water that had stood undisturbed through the ages, so that all sediment had settled out of it, leaving it clear as a trout stream. He could see the inclined floor of the gallery sinking away at the same angle into the depths. Craig switched off the flashlight, conserving the batteries. "Well, Sam," Craig put one hand on his shoulder, "here's your big chance to swim like a fish." Tungata's chuckle was brief and insincere, and they both looked across at Wuzamanzi. "Where now, revered father?" When Takataka came to these hills, and my grandfather and my father saved the king's body from defilement, there had been 7 long, terrible years of drought scorching the land. The level of the water in this shaft was much lower than it is now. Down there, Vuzumanzi pointed into the limpid depths, there is another branch of the rock. In that place, they laid Lobengula's body. In the many years since then, good and plentiful rains have blessed the land, and each year the level of these waters has risen. The first time I visited this place, brought here by my father, the waters were below that pointed rock. Briefly, Craig switched on the flashlight, and in its beam the splintered limestone lay 30 feet or more below the surface. But even then, the king's grave was far below the surface.
So you have never seen the grave with your own eyes? Craig demanded.
Never, Vuzumanzi agreed. But my father described it to me.
Craig knelt at the edge of the lake and put his hand into the water. It was so cold that he shivered and jerked his hand out. He dried it on his shirt, and when he looked up, Tungata was watching him with a quizzical expression.
Now you just hold on there, my beloved Matabele brother, Craig said vehemently. I know exactly what that look means, and you can forget all about it.
I cannot swim, Pufo, my friend.
Forget it, Craig advised him.
We will tie one of the ropes around you. You can come to no harm.
You know where you can put your ropes.
The torch is waterproof. It will shine under water,
Tungata went on with equanimity.
Christ, Craig said bitterly. African rule number 1, when all else fails, look around for the nearest white face.
Do you remember how you swam across the Limpopo River for a ridiculous wager? A case of beer?
Tungata asked sweetly.
That day I was drunk. Now I'm sober. Craig looked at Sally Ann for support and was disappointed.
Oh, not you also.
There are crocs in the Limpopo.
No crocs here, she pointed out.
Slowly, Craig began to unbutton his shirt, and Tungata smiled and began readying the rope. They all watched with interest while Craig unstrapped his leg and laid it carefully aside. He stood, one-legged in his underpants, at the edge of the pool, while Tungata fastened the end of the rope around his waist.
Pufo, Tungata said quietly, you will need dry clothes afterwards. Why do you wish to wet these?
Sarah, Craig explained, and glanced at her.
She is Matabele. Nudity does not offend her.
Leave him his secrets, Sarah smiled, though I have none from him.
And Craig remembered her naked in the water below the bridge. He sat on the edge of the rock slab and pulled off his underpants, tossing them on top of the heap of clothing. Neither of the girls averted their eyes, and he slid into the water, gasping at the cold. He paddled out gently into the centre of the pool and trod water.
Time me, he called back to them. Give me a double tug on the rope every 60 seconds. At 3 minutes, pull me up regardless, okay?
Okay.
Tungata had the coils of rope between his feet, ready to feed out. Craig hung in the water and began to hyperventilate, pumping his lungs like a bellows, purging them of carbon dioxide. It was a dangerous trick. An inexperienced diver could black out from oxygen starvation before the build-up of CO2 triggered the urge to breathe again. He grabbed a full lung and flipped his leg and lower body above the surface in a duck dive and went down cleanly into the cold, clear water. Without a glass faceplate, his vision was grossly distorted, but he held the flashlight beam on the sharp pinnacle of limestone 30 feet below and went down swiftly, the pressure popping and squeaking in his ears. He reached it and gave himself a push-off from the rock. He was going down more readily now as the water pressure compressed the air in his lungs and reduced his buoyancy. The steep, rocky floor of the pool flew in a myopic blur past his face, and he rolled on his side and scanned the walls of gleaming limestone on each side for an opening. There was a double tug on the rope around his waist. 1 minute gone, and he saw the entrance to the tomb below him. It was an almost circular opening in the left-hand wall of the main gallery, and it reminded Craig of the empty eye socket in a human skull. He sank down towards it and put out a hand to brace himself on the limestone sill above the opening. The mouth of the tomb was wide enough for a man to stoop through. He ran his hand over the walls, and they were polished by running water and silky with a coating of slime. Craig guessed that this was a drain hole from the earth's surface, carved out of the limestone by the filtering of rainwaters over the millennium. He was suddenly afraid. There was something forbidding and threatening about this dark entrance. He glanced back towards the surface. He could see the faint, reflected glow of old Wuzamanzi's lantern 40 feet above him, and the icy water sapped his vitality and courage. He wanted to thrash wildly back towards the surface, and he felt the first involuntary pumping of his lungs. Something tugged at his waist, and for an instant he teetered on the edge of wild panic before he realized it was the signal. 2 minutes, almost his limit. He forced himself forward into the entrance of the tomb. It angled gently upwards again, round a sewer pipe. Craig swam for 20 feet, flashing the torch beam ahead of him, but the water was turning murky and dark as he stirred up the sediment from the floor.